We learned a little bit about, we kind of had this contrast between Pat and Lee, remember that? And so we kind of used that to broach the question of, well, what are the, are there objective conditions for happiness? We kind of correlated that a little bit with some ancient philosophy, right? So we had Plato telling us that, the happy life is the one in which you're focused on knowledge of transcendent reality, knowledge of the good. Remember the Scala Amoris, put through your notes so at the end and remind yourself just to reinforce it. And then we had a discussion of that. Now we're going to kind of deepen that a little bit more. So let's get into the Vetrano reading first. And I kind of wanted to give you a diagram for thinking about the various positions that get discussed in that piece. So let's think about it. So you could use a kind of continuum, again, where you have kind of subjective and objective. And what we want to appreciate here is the range of nuanced positions. So let's say that this is going to be a thick subjective, and this is going to be kind of thick objective. So as you move, there's a kind of gradient here. So as you move across this continuum, you get kind of thicker objective views or thicker subjective views. So let's see how we can kind of arrange things here. Obviously, Aristotle gets to go over here all the time, right? And let's just remind ourselves of a couple of attributes of his objective view. Not only does he think, let's get this in your notes for today, not only does he think that to be happy you have to become the sort of thing you are, remember that cool elliptical phrase? Happiness is objective. Because you have a reality, you have a telos, just like the acorn. Remember this from last time? So happiness, not only does he think that happiness involves something objective, it's one thing, right? It's to realize your rational nature. Activity of the soul in accordance with virtue. And the virtue there means the excellences of what's distinctive about you as a creature. So the thing I want to call attention to today, though, is that happiness is unitary for Aristotle. And the classical philosophers in the West just had this real bias. I mean, it's not really a bias. I'll explain it to you. I'll give it a sympathetic reading to it. But they did have a kind of orientation toward thinking that if something's real, let's get this in your notes, if something's real, it has an essence. And if it has an essence, it's one thing. Can we get that intuition in your notes? This is a common intuition for classical Greek philosophers. I'll repeat it. If something's real, it has an essence. If something has an essence, it's one thing. So if happiness is real, it can't be composite. If there's an essence to happiness, then it's what then it can't be composite. It can't be made up of more than one thing. Do you feel the intuition behind that? Because if it was composite, then it would be made up of things that had other essences, right? So it wouldn't be happiness. Happiness wouldn't be an essence. It would be a collection of two other real things. See? So put in your notes this way, just Greeks thought in terms of being real and being unitary or essential kind of go together for Greeks. We tend to have a more naturalistic attitude because we've kind of grown up learning in the wake of the scientific revolution, and we tend to realize that nature makes things in bunches. Let's get that phrase into your notes. By contrast to this classical philosopher's intuition, nature seems to make things in bunches. You get a bunch of animals that look like us. You get a bunch of animals that look like rhinoceroses. You get a bunch of animals that look like a certain kind of birds. So nature produces batches of things, and essences are a little harder to track in an evolutionary environment, right? When did we become essentially human? Well, after Darwin, it's just kind of hard to answer that question in any particularly meaningful way, right? Okay, so we have kind of a contrast between kind of paradigms of what it means for something to be real. And that showed up last time, because we were talking about maybe we could be objective about happiness and say that there's a bundle or a set of things. And maybe the items in this set are not all required, but maybe it's just a pick one kind of situation. So remember, the set could include developing your talents, being a good partner, helping others, being engaged in community pursuits. No, there could be, the point for your notes is, you could be objective about happiness, but not quite as, quite in the way Aristotle is, not quite as thick an objective view as Aristotle. If you just thought there was a kind of bundle of sufficient, now here we're going to use this language, but not, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, sufficient but not necessary conditions for happiness. Notice, right? So there's different life, maybe there's different lifestyles that could count as candidates for a happy life, so that we're not locked into this idea that you find in Plato and Aristotle that ultimately the only really happy people are philosophers. Remember that from last time? That seemed a little suspicious. It's well justified within their views of the distinctiveness of reason, right? But we might want to back off that. We might want to give ourselves some other choices. Remember, we're trying to build a theory that makes sense for us. And you might, you know, you might decide your own notion, but you might not. Okay, so let's take a look at some. So we had this is kind of the idea that happiness might have to do with just, you know, types of good life, bundles or types of happy lives. Okay. Weaker than that, you could. I'm not sure where these fall exactly on the continuum. I'm not being that precise, but weaker than that, you could say that a happy life just has certain kinds of features. So you see how that's thinner than talking about a type of life? See, suppose you think that I can only be this objective about happiness. Happy lives have certain kinds of features. What could the candidate features be? Can we make a little list? I won't write them on the board. Preponderance of happy states over unhappy states, right? Real connection with others. Things go well. Absence of certain kinds of tragedies. So do you see how we're moving toward a weaker, more subjective model here? Well, let's just cut to the chase. At the far end of the thick subjective model is that self-reports are incorrigible. And that means you can't, that's not a word that you commonly use, but the extreme subjectivist argues that you can never call into doubt, that's what incorrigible means, you can never call into doubt a person's self-report. There's no basis for knowing someone, whether someone's happy. There's no epistemic basis, let's use the fancy language, epistemic relating to the grounds of knowing, right? There's no epistemic basis for determining whether someone is happy apart from them saying, I'm happy, I'm not happy, I'm really not happy. So that's the extreme subjectivist view. You can't call into question. So on the extremes, you can't call into question someone's self-reported. It's kind of like if I tell you that Jamocha almond fudge is my favorite flavor of ice cream. And you were to say, no, it isn't. Right? It's like, what do you mean? I get to say what my favorite flavor of ice cream. Now, I could be tricking you. It could be that everybody knows it's really orange sherbet. But, you know, so if you're really in on it, you could say, oh, he's just joking. It's really orange sherbet. He's lying to you. But, you know, so you'd have to have other reports from me to say that. You couldn't just say, I don't think so. Yeah, I just don't think that's your favorite flavor. That'd be so annoying. You just want to go, let's stop that. So that's the idea. Now, so we've got kind of a continuum. Let's fill it out a little bit more. If you look at this, if you follow with me on page 49. Did you guys make a decision about how you're going to bring text to class? I see some printed text. That's exciting. Some on screen.
What if
someone says that they're happy, but
you can just kind of read from like their body language or just how their tone of voice
says that it's not? Yeah, you can. I mean, I guess it's a good challenge, because I was saying, you know, they're incorrigible, can't raise any doubts, right? And now you're wondering, well, maybe it could, right? Maybe it's the person.
If you listen to someone long enough that you just know, like, certain things that have said them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
don't show it.
Yeah, you read them. You can read them and say, are you sure? You know, I've seen you eat a lot of different flavors of ice cream. I've never even seen you talk about a favorite one. All of a sudden you have a favorite? Really? So I guess this is, you know, this is a strong word to use. And I guess you're questioning that, which is really good. Others? Does anybody else want to jump in here? Take a digression on this. Yeah, please.
Well, I think even on that, you're still kind of self-reporting, but just, like, not verbally. So it's the same kind of scenario. I don't think you could be like, I see you sad, but, like, you're not really sad.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It would just be more of an extensive definition of
sad. Yeah, you might want to use the word self-disclosing. Some people say you betray yourself if you're betraying a little uncertainty about that or something. Are you sure? So yeah, that would work. But by and large, you wouldn't say that you had a different. The key distinction at this end of the continuum is you don't have another basis for figuring it out. For instance, one thing we do in happiness research is we'll ask your friends if you're a happy person. We'll ask you how happy you are, and then we'll ask your friends how happy you are. And there's usually a pretty high correlation between those things. If you're really a subjectivist about happiness, that correlation is meaningless. It's just kind of accidental. There's no way in which we're learning something about your happiness when we ask you guys about your happiness. Yeah.
I was just can you actually self-report happiness? Because do you really know what? Like in comparison to other people, maybe, or even not in comparison, do you know what happiness is? Like, just comparing to yourself at a different time. Like, I might say I'm a 7 out of 10 right now, but I also might say I'm a 7 out of 10 at a point where I don't feel like this at all. I feel completely different, and I'm quantifying it in the same way, but they embody different.
You've got a good question, which is a little separate from the continuum question, but it's kind of like, are self-reports any good either? I mean, you didn't really have a problem if you were a subjectivist and then you decided self-reports don't work either. There's a lot of reasons, we're going to get into a lot of the considerations that researchers offer for doubting self-reports on happiness. Self-reports could be influenced by momentary conditions. If I ask you how your life is going on a bad day, I might get a different report if you're having a bad emotional state happiness. There's a lot of reasons for doubting self-reports. But there are also some pretty interesting reasons for trusting them when they are combined with other measures. So we're going to hear some methodology from happiness researchers on that. That's a good question if you wanted to know. Okay, we'll open up the discussion a little more, just a little more content. I did want to pick up some other ideas here, and here I wanted to work now from the subjective side. So the general term that we use here is that subjectivists believe that desire satisfaction is a sufficient condition, necessary and sufficient condition for happiness. And one way to hedge on that and to move in this direction is to add conditions to that. I just wanted to pull, this was in your reading, I just wanted to pull a couple of these out just to get them in your notes now so they're a little more active in your thinking about your theories. For instance, you could say, well, not all desire satisfaction, not all cases of desire satisfaction are sufficient for happiness. They have to be important desires. So that's a hedge. That's a movement toward objective. If you say you're happy and you're reporting satisfying really trivial desires, I'm going to get suspicious. You see how now I'm not going to trust your report completely. I'm going to doubt that a little bit. Really? That you're happy doing that? All day? Okay. Trivial sorts of happiness. Likewise, you could add another condition that the desires actually have to be objectively worthwhile. Now, notice that puts you, I think that puts you kind of over in this territory. So yeah, happiness is about satisfying your desires, but they have to be of worthwhile desires. Notice that's much more open than Aristotle. There's only one kind of desire that you can be satisfying to pursue happiness for Aristotle. It's the desire to develop your rational faculties, right? You see how, is the continuum working for you guys? You've seen how you can really get a lot. The point for your experience today is that you, and to take into the next few weeks is, if anybody asks you whether happiness is subjective or objective, now you've got a lot of vocabulary for not answering the question simply.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? Because a good philosophical answer is one which actually considers more of the possibilities that are there.
So part of my job is to help, and the reading is to help you see, kind of see that there's a lot more possibilities here. Okay? Now, one in particular I wanted to get your reaction on before we go much further. Very famous philosopher Julia Annis, and you won't be surprised to hear that she's an Aristotelian when I remind you that she does think happiness is essentially connected with achievement, achieving your goals. You could actually put goal achievement, you could put goal achievement out here if the goals have to be worthwhile, some objective dimension to the goals. Can we just think about this together? I found myself stopping on this this morning and thinking about it. What sounds right and what sounds wrong in your mind about saying that happiness requires goal achievement? Can we just do this together? I have another opportunity for small group work coming up soon. Just take a minute, no rush. Many philosophers, from the objectivist side especially, would tell you that to be happy, you have to have goals, and your happiness depends to some extent on achieving your goals. What sounds right about that, or what sounds dubious about that?
I think if you're just setting really low goals and you're achieving
right.
that, I think
right.
that's where it kind of falls apart
but,
for me. Like, are you really happy if you're like, oh, I like wrote something down that I already did and then crossed it off, and it was like a simple thing.
Yeah, track this in your notes. Right? We're answering the question, does happiness require goal achievement? Maybe not, because maybe your goals are too trivial. Can't be any goals, right?
Or like maybe immoral goals.
Yeah, well, actually, we need to come back to that. Why do some theorists say that you have to be moral to be happy? That used to totally stump me. I mean, I taught this course for years not understanding that. I haven't answered that. But yeah, okay, good.
But like in favor of the
sure.
idea of goals, when you if your happiness is basically if we're calling happiness your feeling about your life, like how you rate it or something like
yeah.
that,
yeah.
looking back on a lot of successes
yeah.
is probably going to make you rate that experience more
yeah.
positively.
Absolutely. Let me condense it for their notes. We are goal achieving creatures. We get a lot of satisfaction. Goal achievement is satisfying. Happiness is a sort of satisfaction. Right? Seem like they go together. The thought that occurred to me this morning, I'll just add this to your list, and then unless if there's others, we'll stay on this a little longer. I was very suspicious this morning about this idea of Julia Annis, in spite of the fact she's actually quite an accomplished philosopher. I think it's her Aristotelianism talking, frankly, you know. Because it seems to me that achieving my goals does make me happy, so I don't want to dispute that. What I want to dispute is that achieving those goals that I set out is necessary for making me happy. I don't see that. In other words, I guess, let me say it succinctly. Most people can be happy if their goals aren't achieved. I don't think most people will say at the end of their life that. Now, I have some counter data for that. Maybe you guys do too. So my skeptical doubt is that while I think goal pursuit and achievement is a source of happiness, I don't think you have to achieve the goals you set out to be happy. Because very often what happens in the process of achieving some goals that you set out is that you realize that the better goals for you to pursue are slightly different. And if it really depended on the goals that you set going forward, then you'd be in bad shape if you had to achieve those goals to be happy.
Yeah, so I think if you're on the path to achieve a certain goal, not achieving it wouldn't result in unhappiness unless were put on a parallel path that, you know, you're also happy with. Maybe you didn't set a goal to be on that path, but
yeah.
It's something
yeah.
parallel and you're fine
good.
With it.
Yeah,
that's a nice way to put it in terms of parallel paths. I mean, it suggests that our strategies for happiness are going to determine partly how well we're satisfied, right? If you put all your eggs in one basket, you can't imagine any parallel set of goals that might be realized that you hadn't been thinking of, you know. That's a strategy for happiness. Now, another person might have a strategy that's more of a diversifier strategy. Say, well, this is my goal. This is what I think is going to make me happy. But, you know, that's a few years out. Who knows? We'll have to see. We're going to get a lot of feedback. Maybe it's going to be this, you know. So I think I'm suspicious of people who put too much of a focus on a particular set of goals, because a lot happens, a lot changes in the process. Any other thoughts on that, please? Yeah.
So especially as, like, college students trying to figure out what your goals should be, it kind of puts a lot of pressure. It would kind of indicate that you couldn't be happy unless you had a goal that you were actively pursuing, which for a lot of people in college is not necessarily true.
That's very helpful. A lot of you are pursuing lots of goals, and some of you would be hard pressed to say, well, you know, which one of these are essential to my happiness. You don't know how well they're going to be realized until some of these are very long term goals. Depend on how your career is going to go. My son graduated with a degree in cultural studies and photography. He really liked what he studied. But it's not obvious that leads to a career path. He's really good at making espresso drinks. So he can get a barista job in Chicago at the drop of a hat. He just got a new one and he started today. So, you know, but it's not clear that his happiness is going to be... So some of you are pursuing studies that have very much more specific, like my other son, computer engineer. You know, his studies had a much more specific relationship to a set of goals that he wants to achieve. Now, how important career goals are to happiness, notice we shouldn't assume that those are necessarily the things to focus on, okay? Okay, so achievements in there is a kind of separate topic. What I'd like to move us toward, though, is this interesting conversation at the end of the article about Jane. This would be a neat one to do some small group work on. Because here's the point for your notes. Vitrano thinks that the example of Jane, let's get Jane's example out first and then say what it means. Who is Jane? Can somebody help us with that? Remember? Yeah.
Was that the woman whose husband was having?
Right. So Jane is a happy woman, happily married woman, but she's deceived, right? Make sure you understand that in your notes. And so what we want to know is, does her deception compromise her happiness? Does the fact that she's deceived mean she's not really happy? And what Vitrano wants to say, Vitrano's a subjectivist, that Jane, the thought experiment of Jane, this is a kind of thought experiment. Imagine this fictional person, Jane. Vitrano thinks it's obvious that Jane is no less happy for not knowing about her husband, right? She dies not knowing that he cheated on her, right? And she thinks this is the counter, put this in your notes, this is Jane's, the thought experiment with Jane is the counterexample to an objectivist position. Because the objectivist is kind of forced to say, Jane's happiness was an illusion. Now, after last class, I think most of you are willing to say the experience machine produces an illusory happiness, right? That's our reference point for illusory happiness. And you can always be a real philosopher and take that argument on. No, maybe the experience machine is real happiness. Okay, but so the question is Jane's illusory happiness like the experience machine's? And that would tell you that you were more of an objectivist. Part of what I want you to do is, you know, I want you to do over 15 weeks is develop a full theory of happiness. One part of that theory you're going to work on in the next couple of minutes in small group. You're already thinking about it, right? And that is, how do I respond to the Jane thought experiment? Does it trigger objectivist intuitions in me? Like, oh no, Jane's happiness wasn't real. Or does it make the case that Vitrano thinks it makes, which is that it's obvious Jane's happy, you know. So she thinks the thought experiment really delivers a pretty straight
pump of your intuitions about happiness, and it answers the theoretical question. You should be a subjectivist. It's, as you might suspect, it's not that simple, right? So what I'd like you to do is get into small groups and complicate it. Go around and figure out what everybody's reaction to the Jane situation is, and then try to figure out what assessment you want to make of Jane's happiness. And don't assume it's a thumbs up or thumbs down. I mean, one of the things we're learning is that when you do philosophy, you wind up complicating issues in some interesting ways, okay? So could you evaluate the Jane thought experiment in about 5-7 minutes, get into small groups, introduce yourselves, see who you're talking to, move your chairs around, relax, enjoy your conversation. Take some notes.